History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 64, Harvard Indian College, Promises Broken and Kept. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to discuss the commitment written right into Harvard's charter to educate the Native American youth of Massachusetts. We'll look at the early, mostly unsuccessful efforts to create an Indian college on the Harvard campus, the abandonment of that plan after King Philip's War soured the English settlers on their earlier plans for Christianizing the Native Americans, and how modern scholarship is helping to rediscover this legacy and rededicate Harvard to embracing Native American students. But before we talk about the Harvard Indian College, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
Since this week's show is about the intersection between Native Americans and the English settlers in the early Massachusetts Bay Colony, we wanted to highlight a Native American historic site in Boston this week. Unfortunately, not a lot have survived almost four centuries of development. There are places where important archaeological discoveries have been made, like a shell midden that marked a large Indian encampment on the ground that's now Boston Common, or the fish weir that was discovered in the Back Bay during construction of the Boylston Street subway that indicates that natives inhabited the area for at least 5,000 years. However, there's not much to see if you visit those locations. There's a lot to see if you visit the Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology, but we already covered that a couple of weeks ago. So we're going to journey out of Boston for your site this week. Just across the Neponset River, our southerly neighbor Quincy has preserved a Native American historic site. Just off of Wollaston Beach, near the corner of Quincy Shore Drive and Squantum Street, there's a small, rocky hill called Mosswatusett Hummock. In the pre-contact era, and in the very earliest days of the Bay Colony, this hill belonged to an important sachem of the Massachusetts people named Chickatobit. Chickatobit's main seat of power was at a place called Conahasset, near today's Scituate. Mosswatusett was a sort of outpost, or a secondary home, that might have been used seasonally. It was at Mosswatusett that he met with the pilgrim leader Miles Standish in 1621, and from there that he journeyed to Boston to break bread with John Winthrop in 1631. Winthrop's journal from March of 1631 records one of the earliest of many visits. Chickatobit came with his sanops and squaws and presented the governor with a hogshead of Indian corn. After they had all dined and had each a small cup of sack and beer, and the men tobacco, he sent away all his men and women. Himself and one squaw and one sanop stayed all night and, being in English clothes, the governor set him at his own table, where he behaved himself as soberly as an Englishman. The next day after dinner, he returned home, the governor giving him cheese and peas and a mug and some other small things. The name Mosswatusett is often translated to mean Arrowhead Hill based on a mid-18th century account that said, "Arrowheads are called in their language moss or mons with the O nasal, and hill in their language is Watusett." But some alternate translations say that it's site of the great house. As the English became acquainted with Chickatobit, they would use the name Mosswatusett or Massachusetts to refer to the tribe, the land, the bay, and eventually the colony. Unfortunately, Chickatobit's relationship with Winthrop and the people of Boston was short-lived. Winthrop's journal from 1633 records an event that is no less tragic for being entirely typical of the relationship between the natives of New England and their new neighbors. November 1633. A great mortality among the Indians. Chickatobit, the Sagamore of Neponset, died, and many of his people. The disease was smallpox. Some of them were cured by such means as they had from us. Many of their children escaped and were kept by the English. Today, the hummock has some interpretive signs and a short trail around its perimeter. It's an easy walk from the public parking areas at Wollaston Beach, or a 25-minute walk from the North Quincy Red Line Station.
And for our upcoming event this week, we're returning to the Massachusetts Historical Society. On Wednesday, February 7th, MHS is hosting a talk by Lisa Brooks of Amherst College and Christine DeLucia of Mount Holyoke. They'll be discussing their recent work viewing King Philip's War from new perspectives. King Philip's War raged across Massachusetts and all of New England in the 1670s, and it fundamentally changed the relationship between the English colonists and their Native American neighbors. From the MHS website, two historians re-examine the narrative of one of colonial America's most devastating conflicts. Lisa Brooks recovers a complex picture of war, captivity, and Native resistance during the First Indian War by relaying the stories of Witamu, a female Wampanoag leader, and James Printer, a Nipmuc scholar, whose stories converge in the captivity of Mary Rowlandson. Christine DeLuccia offers a major reconsideration of the war, providing an alternative to pilgrim-centric narratives that have dominated the histories of colonial New England, grounding her study in five specific places that were directly affected by the crisis, spanning the Northeast as well as the Atlantic world. These two works offer new perspectives. The program will include short presentations by both scholars, followed by a conversation. There will be a reception at 5:30 p.m. and the talk begins at 6. Registration is required, and tickets are $10 for non-members. We'll have a link to the registration page in the show notes this week. As you'll see in a few moments, King Philip's War is linked to our main topic this week, and one of the central figures in this talk plays a role in our story.
The students of Harvard University have always been treated to an over-the-top spectacle during their commencement week. Though the university was founded in 1636, the first commencement wasn't held until 1642. That first year, there were orations in Greek, Latin, and Hebrew, followed by disputations on questions of philosophy. A feast followed, with speeches by the college president and the governor of the colony. A loving cup, or grace cup, was passed hand to hand and mouth to mouth. By 1703, records show that the small graduating class had reason to order 14 barrels of beer, 1 barrel of cider, and 18 gallons of wine. The commencement feast slowly grew to become a commencement week, full of celebrations both somber and frivolous. In 2011, commencement week began on Tuesday with an address by National Book Award winner Joyce Carol Oates, and wrapped up on Friday with an address by Indira Gandhi Prize for Peace, Disarmament, and Development winner Ila Bhatt. In between, the graduates were honored with a number of dinners, ceremonies, and speeches, including this one, where comedian Amy Poehler makes a joke about the man in a chicken suit who would go on to become our president.
Live television can be very nerve-wracking, and I remember one time being nervous, looking into the eyes of the host, and feeling better. I should point out I was wearing a chicken suit at the time. The host was Donald Trump. He was wearing a bigger, more elaborate chicken suit. I looked into his eyes. I saw that he looked really stupid, and I instantly felt better.
Folks, I checked it out, and that skit is real. But there's a conspiracy theory that says that it's been suppressed from online sources and DVD collections.
Talk, you know our rings, come with me, celebrate. Chop it, you know the babies are good for you.
Chop, if you want some cheese, grab me another extra. Down the halfway.
The sketch, by the way, has actually been removed, I don't know why, from Hulu, from some of SNL's greatest hits. It's unclear why.
On Thursday, May 26, 2011, one of the graduates eagerly waiting to receive that coveted Harvard diploma was Tiffany Smalley. Smalley grew up on Martha's Vineyard as a member of the Wampanoag tribe of Aquinna. When she walked down the aisle to receive her degree, she would be the first Wampanoag to do so since 1665, a gap of 346 years.
Harvard was founded in the early years of Massachusetts Bay Colony in hopes that the new province would one day be able to educate its own clergy rather than convincing new ministers to immigrate from England. A pamphlet published in 1643 sums it up. After God had carried us safe to New England and we had builded our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government, one of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in the dust. Just 6 years after John Winthrop and his Puritan followers settled on the tiny peninsula they called Boston, the Great and General Court of Massachusetts met on September 8, 1636. The court agreed to give £400 toward a school or college, whereof £200 to be paid the next year, and £200 when the work is finished, and the next court to appoint where and what building. The next court met in November of 1637 and decided the college is ordered to be at Newtown. Then, in May of 1638, they decided it is ordered that Newtown shall henceforward be called Cambridge. When the Great and General Court was debating what town and building to use for the new college, a Puritan minister in Charlestown fell ill. John Harvard was just 30 years old, but he had acquired a case of consumption and was soon on his deathbed. The other ministers from towns around Massachusetts Bay would visit him during his slow decline. Knowing that Harvard was a graduate of Emmanuel College back in England, many would give him updates on the slow but steady progress they were making toward establishing a college of their own at Newtown, or Cambridge, as they were getting used to calling it.
John Harvard had a lifelong love of learning. He was the son of a butcher, born in Surrey in 1607. The family attended the same church as William Shakespeare, and the father, Robert Harvard, held important positions at the parish school. John went through the parish school, but was pushed into an apprenticeship rather than higher education. After a series of tragic deaths and hopeful remarriages, John found himself one of the sole surviving heirs to the growing fortune of the much smaller Harvard family. He used his inheritance to pay his own way to Emmanuel College in 1627, where he earned an M.A. by 1635 and was ordained as a Puritan minister. In 1636, he married a woman named Anne Sadler, and by the summer of 1637, the happy couple had boarded a ship for New England to start a new life. Just over a year later, John Harvard died on September 14, 1638. Before he did, he dictated a new will to Anne, disposing of the sizable fortune he had inherited from his father, his brother, and his mother, who had in turn inherited a small fortune from her second husband. The couple hadn't yet had any children, so John knew what he wanted to do with his money. He willed half to Anne, and stipulated that the other half should go to the new college at Newtown. This endowment was about £800, or twice what the college had gotten from the colonial government. Almost as valuable as the money, John Harvard also willed his scholar's library, some 400 books, to the school. In gratitude, the Great and General Court gave the school a new name the following March. It is ordered that the college agreed upon formerly to be built at Cambridge shall be called Harvard College.
In 1650, the Great and General Court granted Harvard a formal charter, which set up the president and fellows of the school as a governing board. Now considered the oldest corporation in the Americas, the Harvard Corporation still acts as the highest level of governance over the university. In that 1650 charter, there is one line that sounds an odd note to the modern reader. Many well-devoted persons have been and daily are moved and stirred up to give and bestow sundry gifts, legacies, lands, and revenues for the advancement of all good literature, arts, and sciences in Harvard College in Cambridge in the county of Middlesex, and to the maintenance of the president and fellows, and for all accommodations of buildings and all other necessary provisions that may conduce to the education of the English and Indian youth of this country in knowledge and godliness. You may wonder why the charter stresses that the college will educate both white and Native American youth. While he was working with the legislature to come up with the text of the charter, we have to imagine that Harvard President Harry Dunster was the Puritan equivalent of a cartoon character with dollar signs for eyes. The bequest from John Harvard was pretty nice, but it wasn't enough money to run a college on in the long run. As they were getting the school up and running, Dunster and the Harvard Fellows were looking for alternative sources of funding, and they soon came up with a scheme. Back in London, many of the most wealthy and influential men belonged to an organization called the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in New England. The Protestant Society had been largely inspired by the work of missionary John Eliot. Eliot was the minister of the Puritan Church at Roxbury, and starting in the mid-1640s, he began proselytizing to the Native Americans in the countryside surrounding Boston. Early on, he realized that he would need to learn the Algonquian dialects that his audience spoke if he was going to have any impact at all, and soon he was preaching in the Massachusetts language.
Eliot began seeing success when a group of Massachusetts under a leader named Wabon was receptive to his teachings. Eventually, he was able to convince entire villages to convert to Christianity, becoming known as Praying Indians. This success electrified Puritan observers back in England. One of the stated aims of colonizing New England had been to spread the Protestant faith among the region's natives, but there had been little success up to this point. With Eliot seemingly succeeding, he was able to convince supporters to form a financial partnership to support his efforts. In 1649, the society was formed with the mission of preaching and propagating of the gospel of Jesus Christ among the natives, and also for maintaining of schools and nurseries of learning, and for the better education of the children of the natives. Knowing that donations were flowing into the society's coffers, the Harvard Fellows wrote that sentence about the education of English and Indian youth into their charter the following year. Their stated goal was to give promising young men from the bands of Praying Indians a Protestant English education, and then they in turn would return to their praying villages as clergymen and civic leaders. With the influx of funds from the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in New England, the Harvard Corporation built the first building intended for the Indian College in 1655. It was the fourth building on Harvard Yard, the second built for instructional use, and the first brick building on the campus. In 1934, an architectural historian did an exhaustive study of the cost of building materials, the designs of surviving buildings from the same time period, contemporaneous maps and sketches of the Harvard campus, and other sources to create a conjectural reconstruction of the building. The resulting image, which we'll have in the show notes, reveals a long, narrow building with three chimneys and two doors. The two-story building was designed to house 20 students, including up to six Native American scholars. It had instructional space, quiet nooks for studying, and a print shop.
When those two doors opened in 1656, there were no Native American students enrolled at the Harvard Indian College. Instead, the white sons of English settlers moved into the Indian College for the first 5 years, while promising Massachusetts students were sent to prep schools in Roxbury, Dorchester, and Boston. Before they could attend Harvard, they had to be proficient in Latin, Greek, and of course English. While the intended beneficiaries of the Indian College were getting their introductory coursework out of the way, John Eliot also moved into the Indian College at Harvard. The first printing press in America had arrived in 1638 on a ship with Elizabeth Glover. After her husband died at sea during the voyage from England, Elizabeth was left with two of her own children, three of his from an earlier marriage, an indentured servant, and his children. Since law and custom at the time didn't allow a woman to own property or operate a business independently, Elizabeth reached an agreement with the indentured servant, Stephen Day, and his son Matthew, to operate the press on her behalf. Arriving in Cambridge, Elizabeth Glover leased out the land she had inherited and used the money to purchase a large house. The print shop was installed on the first floor, where the 1639 Oath of a Freeman was pressed, the first printed page in British North America. Within a few years, she was remarried to Henry Dunster, the president of Harvard College. As a married couple, management of her print shop fell to Dunster. At the time, it was located in their home. After Elizabeth's death in 1643, Henry continued to operate the press for a decade or more. And when the new Indian College building was completed, the printing press and all of the supporting materials were moved into space in the new building that had been set aside for them.
In the early 1650s, John Eliot embarked on the project for which he is perhaps best remembered. He set out to translate the Christian Bible into Algonquian. A Massachusetts schoolteacher named John Sassamon worked with him as a translator, then later a Nipmuc man whose name is most commonly recorded as James Printer worked to proof their translations and set the type to print them on the press that had been Elizabeth Glover's. When the Bible was finally published in 1663, it was the first Bible printed in the American colonies in any language. It was also a great victory for Eliot and the society, as a central tenet of the Puritan religion held that faith in Christ could only be attained through prayer and reading the Bible. Finally, the Puritans' native neighbors could read the Bible in their own language. John Sassamon and James Printer both spent time on the Harvard campus. John Eliot encouraged Sassamon to take classes, though the Indian College was not yet in operation. Printer worked in the Harvard Indian College building, where the press was housed. However, they were both older and aren't considered students of the Indian College. The first class of students was still in prep school, getting their Harvard prerequisites out of the way. Unfortunately, the crowded conditions of a prep school proved to be the perfect breeding ground for European diseases that these promising Native American students had no immunity to. Consumption seemed to take the heaviest toll, greatly reducing the number of Native students who would matriculate to Harvard.
Finally, two Wampanoag boys had completed their training in Greek and Latin and were ready to begin studying at Harvard in 1661. Joel Eacombs was the son of an interpreter who had worked with the missionary Thomas Mayhew. Caleb Chishatomic was the son of an important sachem. And we do apologize if we've mispronounced either of these names. Both were members of the Aquinnah Wampanoag tribe from Martha's Vineyard. The Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in New England supported the students with clothing, books, paper, ink, and paid their tuition. By all accounts, they were every bit the equal of their English classmates. The 1665 college bylaws give a hint as to what their education experience was like. In the first year after admission, for 4 days of the week, all students shall be exercised in the study of the Greek and Hebrew tongues, only beginning logic in the mornings towards the latter end of the year, unless the tutor shall see cause by reason of their ripeness in the languages to read logic sooner. Also, they shall spend the second year in logic with the exercise of the former languages, and the third year in the principles of ethics, and the fourth in metaphysics and mathematics, still carrying on their former studies of the week for rhetoric, oratory, and divinity.
One source says that John Winthrop the Younger, the son of Boston founder John Winthrop, and then governor of Connecticut, witnessed an oral examination taken by both students in Latin in 1663, and that they acquitted themselves well. Winthrop also sent an essay written by Caleb Chishatomic in the same year to Robert Boyle, who in turn deposited it in the archives of the Royal Society in London, where it remains today. Titled Honoratissimi Benefactores, the essay is written in Latin as a note of thanks to the honored benefactors in Old England who had supported his education. It opens with a long allusion to a lyre that Orpheus received from Apollo, before the closing paragraphs heap praise on the society's donors. The Lord delegated you to be our patrons, and he endowed you with all wisdom and intimate compassion, so that you may perform the work of bringing blessing to us pagans, who derive our life and origin from our forebears. We were naked in our souls as well as in our bodies. We were aliens from all humanity, and we were led around in the desert by various errors. O threefold and fourfold, most illustrious and most loving men, what kind of thanks, if not the greatest and most immense, should we give to you, for that you have supported us with an abundance of all things for our education and for the sustenance of our bodies? You have poured forth immense, the greatest resources. Even though we cannot commensurately reciprocate your kindness and that of our other benefactors, we do hope, however. We are not left alone praying before the Lord with importunate supplications for those pious and merciful men who are still in the Old England, who dispersed so much gold and silver for us to obtain the salvation of our souls, and for you as well, who were instruments like aqueducts in bestowing all these benefits upon us. Most devoted to your dignity, Caleb Chishatomic.
Although his writings didn't survive, sources from the time imply that Joel Eacombs was seen as an even more promising student. Writing later about Caleb and Joel, Daniel Guggen, superintendent of the Praying Indians, would say, "These two were hopeful young men, especially Joel, being so ripe in learning that he should, within a few months, have taken his degree of Bachelor of Art in college. He was a good scholar and a pious man, as I judge. I knew him well, for he lived and was taught in the same town where I dwell. I observed him for several years after he was grown to years of discretion, to be not only a diligent student, but an attentive hearer of God's word, diligently writing the sermons and frequenting lectures, grave and sober in his conversation." Both of our young Wampanoags were scheduled to march in the commencement ceremonies with the class of 1665. Joel Eacombs was expected to be the class valedictorian. However, while Caleb did walk and receive his baccalaureate from Harvard, Joel did not. Returning to Daniel Guggen, he recorded, "He took a voyage to Martha's Vineyard to visit his father and kindred, a little before the commencement, but upon his return back in a vessel with other passengers and mariners, suffered shipwreck upon the island of Nantucket. The boat was found on Nantucket Island, but no trace of the passengers was ever discovered." The story of Caleb Chishatomic doesn't have a happy ending either. Having escaped European disease while at a prep school in Roxbury, and again living in close quarters with both native and English students at the Indian College building, Caleb's luck soon ran out. He moved to Watertown after graduation, but within a few short months, he had to be placed under the care of a doctor. The consumption that he had avoided in the past had finally caught up to him, and Harvard's first Native American graduate passed away in 1666 at 20 years old.
If that seems like a bad omen, perhaps it was. Caleb Chishatomic was the first graduate of Harvard Indian College. He would also be the last. The school always suffered from a shortage of students, due in no small part to the high mortality rate among the Native American students at the surrounding preparatory schools, but also to the implicit demand that an applicant must be ready to commit cultural suicide, to eradicate every trace of his language and heritage and replace them with English customs. Even the handful of young men who did make it to Harvard didn't make it to commencement. Some died, and some left, but none would graduate. In 1665, the same year Caleb and Joel were scheduled to graduate, a young man named John Wampus enrolled at Harvard. He was a Nipmuc from near Grafton, Massachusetts, and he was described as a towardly lad and apt wit for a scholar. However, the Harvard life didn't agree with him. After just 1 year on campus, he left and went to sea. A decade later, a man named Eleazar came to the Indian College as a member of the class of 1679. He's believed to have been a Wampanoag, although his exact home and tribal affiliation aren't known. Like Caleb Chishatomic, a fragment of Eleazar's writing remains. He wrote an elegy to a teacher named Thomas Thatcher, composed in the form of a poem in Latin, with the last four lines in Greek. Cotton Mather would use a fragment of it as an epitaph for Thatcher in his work Magnalia Christi Americana. Unfortunately, Eleazar died of smallpox in 1679, before reaching graduation.
At the same time, King Philip's War destroyed the previously harmonious relationship between the English colonists and their Native American neighbors. Although the rising tensions that led to war are too complex to get into here, one of the events that immediately precipitated the outbreak of violence was the murder of John Sassamon. The Massachusetts man, who had worked closely with John Eliot in preparing the first Algonquian Bible, was found under the ice of a pond near Plymouth. A jury sentenced three Wampanoag followers of Metacomet, or King Philip, to death. Soon war broke out. It would be the bloodiest conflict per capita in American history, with over 3,000 Native Americans killed, along with about 1 in every 10 military-aged English settlers. The Praying Indians were herded into camps on the Boston Harbor Islands, where they died in droves of starvation, disease, and exposure. After the war, the Puritans would never again be optimistic about converting their Native American neighbors to Protestantism and European-style farming. The Harvard Indian College was mostly abandoned, and in 1698, it was torn down and the bricks were recycled in another college building. There's an interesting entry in the notes from a 1685 meeting of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel held in London. Despite the fact that the college building was sitting abandoned and soon to be torn down, and there are no records of an Indian student at Harvard at the time, the society seemed to believe that one student was enrolled, and they were seeking funds for more. Whereas, by the last year's account of expenses from New England, this court doth find that there is only one Indian youth maintained and educated at the college in New England. This court doth think fit, and so expresses it to be their desire that there be 9 other Indian youths disposed of in the said college, to make up the number 10 in all to be educated and maintained and brought up there, in the like manner as that one now there is educated and intended to be brought up. Seeing as there was no Native American student at the college at that time, and that fewer than 10 ever attended the school, we have to wonder if this is evidence of a wee bit of colonial embezzlement.
Even after the building was gone, one final student was enrolled in the Indian College at Harvard. A Nipmuc from near Minden, Massachusetts, was admitted to the class of 1716. Benjamin Larnell died of a fever during his sophomore year, but in the 2 years he was at Harvard, college president John Leverett would describe him as an acute grammarian, an extraordinary Latin poet, and a good Greek one. Which trial judge Samuel Sewell would send a friend a copy of a poem by Larnell in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. After his death, Larnell's pallbearers would include Sewell, Leverett, 2 fellows of the Harvard Corporation, and commissioners of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel. However, there was no surviving evidence of Larnell's extraordinary skills as a poet for over 300 years. That changed 5 years ago when a PhD history student named Stuart McManus was scouring local archives for works written in Latin during the colonial era that would help him determine how use of the language had changed over the centuries. While he was poring over an index of holdings at the Massachusetts Historical Society, he noticed an entry for Benjamin Larnell. It predated Larnell's time at the Indian College, so nobody had made the connection before. In fact, it was written when Larnell was probably only 15 or 16 years old. At the time, young Benjamin was a student at Boston Latin School, where he was being prepped for a course of study at Harvard. He was a few years ahead of his schoolmate Benjamin Franklin, and he was an exceptional enough student to be allowed to skip 2 grades. As a school assignment, he created a Latin versification of the classic prose fable The Fox and the Weasel by Aesop. Now that it's been rediscovered, this single page makes just 3 surviving documents created by the students of Harvard Indian College. The discovery of Benjamin Larnell's long-lost poem marks the culmination of a gradual rediscovery of the legacy of the Indian College. After King Philip's War, the school was largely forgotten or erased from public memory. Only since the 1990s has the school been rediscovered. In 1997, the school and the Harvard University Native American Program, or HUNAP, placed a plaque to mark the original location of the Indian College. Since then, archaeology students studying under the direction of Harvard faculty and the Peabody Museum have found the remains of the building itself. In 2009, they discovered a dark strip of soil that turned out to be the trench where one of the Indian College's walls had run. Surrounding it, they found slate pencils, musket balls, beads, pottery, pipe stems, and other artifacts from Harvard's earliest days. The students then spent nearly 2 years cleaning, researching, and cataloging their finds before excavation began again in 2011. Among their most exciting discoveries has been lead type from the printing press that used to operate at the Indian College, and that might have been used to print John Eliot's 1663 Algonquian Bible.
Though the student body is now made up of 2-3% Native Americans, there had been no Wampanoag graduate since Caleb Chishatomic in 1665. In 2011, as Tiffany Smalley prepared herself to be the first Wampanoag to walk down that aisle in 346 years, she knew that she would not be the only member of her tribe to be honored that day. In a special ceremony attended by dozens of Wampanoags, Smalley accepted an honorary degree on behalf of Joel Eacombs, Caleb Chishatomic's 1665 classmate who died in a shipwreck on the way to commencement. Smalley said, "I feel honored and am humbled that I have been offered the opportunity to accept the degree on Joel's behalf. I know he and Caleb and all the Indian College students hundreds of years ago helped pave the way for me and my education today. Now that we have come full circle, I feel blessed to be able to play any part in the acknowledgement of his outstanding accomplishments." Harvard President Drew Faust would add, "It is fitting that we honor Joel Eacombs as Harvard marks the 375th anniversary of its founding. With the presentation of this degree, we also recognize some of the commitments that were fundamental to the founding of Harvard, a commitment to a diversity of students, a commitment to the communities in which the college was founded, and a commitment to the power of education to transform lives." And, we might add, it seems to serve as a rededication to the university's original mission, the education of the English and Indian youth of this country.
To learn more about Harvard Indian College, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/064. We'll have links to an architectural recreation of the Indian College building, a copy of the 1650 Harvard Charter, an article analyzing the surviving writings of Caleb Chishatomic and Eleazar, and an article about life on campus for modern Native American students at Harvard. We'll also post a link to the book Colonial Comics, which we use to get an easy-to-understand, well-researched biography of Elizabeth Glover and her printing press. And, of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week.